welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. The interest in alternative medicines has given plant scientists at the University of Lethbridge a new perspective on their work. Dr. Kevin Smith has discovered the medicinal compounds often appear only when the plants are under stress. And Dr. Dan Wehner of the National Institute for Nanotechnology made a splash for Canada at a recent conference in Japan. Imagine trying to network and shake hands with over 20,000 delegates. And trumpeter swans make their way back to Grand Prairie. Reg Arbuckle of Ducks Unlimited has been keeping a watchful eye on these giant birds, their population once very endangered. These are the stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. It's easy to tease Dr. Kevin Smith that he tortures plants. The growth chambers in his lab at the University of Lethbridge are designed to create stressful conditions for the echinacea and sage that he's studying. What he's interested in is producing the special compounds that give these plants their medicinal qualities.
We essentially try to turn on the defense pathways within plants, which are in nature turned on due to either pathogen attack or due to heavy metal situations where there's high concentrations of heavy metals. So in the lab, to simulate this, we either spray these plants with solutions of heavy metal and they believe that they're under some form of attack and they produce these compounds to try to defend themselves. Or we actually treat them with pathogens. We culture and grow microbial pathogens that kill plants, and we treat the plants with those and to see what kind of response that we get.
What are these compounds?
Compounds have various structures. They go across all the different natural product pathways. Different plants produce different compounds. The one thing that they have in common is they play a role in plant defense.
What plants are you dealing with?
We've looked at a number of different plant species. A lot of them are plants that have been utilized in traditional medicine practices, either in other parts of the world or even within North America within the native population. We deal with three different species of echinacea, a number of the plants within the sage family. We've recently started working with some plants that are strictly Chinese medicine type plants to see what we can observe within those plants.
Is this something that you started looking at from an agricultural point of view and it's kind of moved into the medicine side of things?
Yeah, this when we really initiated this work, this was work that we were focusing on determining how plants were protecting themselves so that we could consider increasing harvestable yields and quality. And from that, it's sort of become a quest to look for these compounds as they might act as antimicrobial compounds in medicine and more recently as anti-cancer and anti-inflammatory compounds.
What have you found out so far?
We've been able to show that by stressing these plants, we can produce antimicrobial activity in a significant number of the plants. It's not always difficult to be able to isolate these compounds and identify them because they're produced in very small quantities. It's just been more recently that we've now started to take a look at these same extracts from plants and look at them in other biological systems, such as in cancer tissues. So far, the antimicrobial work has gone well, and we expect the anti-cancer work will go well, but that's still in early stages.
What is going to happen with this anti-cancer work? You just showed me a new lab that you're building that will deal with this.
The lab that I was showing you was a lab for us to be able to culture mammalian cells, which require sort of very sterile conditions to be able to deal with these cultures without contamination. And our plan is now, if everything works the way that we expect it to, is we'll be able to isolate compounds and identify them, and they'll become target compounds for looking either at commercializing or at least as structures to start with in investigating new sort of model compounds that we can use in anti-cancer therapy and anti-inflammatory therapy.
20 years ago, a lot of this stuff was really poo-pooed in terms of the health benefits that plants might have, and yet now this is exactly where research is being done and the promise for new medicines and that is coming from. It's being legitimized in a sense. How have you seen things change, and why do you think this change is coming about?
Where we've seen it change, as far as the public view, has been that the people are looking for alternatives to Western medicines, which have complications and have perhaps been used in improper ways or to excess. Where we've really sort of looked at for our purposes is why might some of the answers that have come back from research 20 years ago or 25 years ago have come back to shown that there isn't anything to do with medicine. And it's our feeling that when scientists have done a lot of these extractions from plants and found that the extracts were not active, it's actually because they've taken them into a different environment than those plants actually grow. And the plants don't grow in a pristine environment where they're unstressed. They grow out in a competitive environment, and sometimes it's this competition for life that actually causes the plants to produce compounds that have special features and features that we might be able to utilize as a medicine.
To take this out of the lab then and turn it into something that can be commercialized, how are you going to go about stressing these plants on a large scale in order to get the quantities of the materials you need in order to make new medicines?
I'm not actually sure at this stage if that's the way things will actually go. I'm not convinced at this point that we can do this as an agricultural type of application. It may be that rather than stressing plants on a large agricultural scale and then isolating compounds or even using these in a more crude form as an alternative medicine, that may not be the best approach. It may be that by doing the research and finding new target compounds that can be useful as antimicrobial agents or as anti-cancer agents or whatever, it just gives us target compounds that we can go back in and look at new medicines to manufacture in a similar Western way, but at least we understand what these medicines are doing and where they come from. About 50% of the medicines that we use have origins in plants. Either they're produced by plants or a compound of similar structure was produced in plants and gave us the idea to make the current compounds.
You're dealing with just a handful of plants here. How big could this field be?
I think it's huge. We've investigated a lot of plants over the years as natural product chemists to look at the compounds that are just constituent compounds that are produced all the time in these plants. But we haven't looked at the compounds that are not normally produced that you actually have to sort of turn them on via stress or by some other pathway. So there's about 250,000 plants that are what's considered flowering plants, and very few of these have been investigated in this way. So there's a lot of possibilities out there.
What's next?
For us, as we move into the anti-cancer therapy stuff, we need to get the assays down so we can actually know what we're seeing and be able to actually validate those activities. After that, as far as choosing plants, everything's wide open at this point. We're going to try to focus on plants that are native to Canada, and especially Western Canada and Southern Alberta, at least in the initial stages.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was Dr. Kevin Smith, an assistant professor in chemistry and biochemistry at the University of Lethbridge. With agencies around the world racing to stake out their territory in the field of nanotechnology, the invitation that arrived on Dr. Dan Wehner's desk came as something of a surprise. He was being asked to give an important presentation at a prestigious conference in Japan. People in other countries were intrigued with the way Canada was approaching its nanotechnology research, and would Dr. Wehner be kind enough to address that topic? Not bad for the fledgling National Institute for Nanotechnology at the University of Alberta. I spoke with Dan Wehner, the acting director general of NINT, when he returned from the conference in Japan.
Well, this conference was called Nanotech 2000 Plus Future, and it was organized by NEDO, which is a Japanese organization. It's NEDO. And it really is probably the largest conference this year in the area of nanotechnology, attracted somewhere around 20 to 25,000 total participants.
How do you shake hands with that many people?
Well, it's I think you have to be a little bit selective. There were really representatives from virtually every major country who's working in the area of nanotechnology. That includes North America, Europe, and Asia. So it was a great opportunity to meet the people who are leading the nanotechnology efforts in each of these countries, and to start to compare notes and to look at how we start to work more closely together.
What was your role over there?
Well, I was asked to give a presentation in a session related to how government can support nanotechnology development. So there were only six countries asked to do this, with Canada being one, and we were then participating in a panel discussion later, that actually followed the presentations. So there were representatives from South America, from Europe, from other parts of Asia, and the U.S.
What was your message in that keynote address?
Well, I started off by giving an overview of what Canada is now doing in terms of investment in nanotechnology, primarily with respect to the NRC's new National Institute for Nanotechnology, which is here on the campus of the University of Alberta. And I described the unique relationship between the NRC and the University of Alberta and the province of Alberta as the founding partners in this institute. I think it really is unique, even on the world stage, and people were really interested in how a university, federal lab, province are all able to work together to drive not only research but innovation in nanotechnology.
What did you tell them was your secret to success?
Well, the secret really is getting the focus, getting the trust between the partners, and just making sure that we cover this continuum of activities from the frontier research all the way through to clear ways to commercialize within the community. So we talked as well about the important role of the community in getting behind all of this effort and driving the development of a cluster of nanotechnology-based firms that, while being local in the Edmonton and eventually Alberta areas, will have a global impact.
Now, you were one of six in this panel. What did the other countries have to offer?
Well, most of the other countries really gave a description of the processes that they have in place to try to organize and coordinate research at the national level. And much of that are things which are already extensions of existing programs. For example, the sixth framework within the European Union has a number of programs supporting nanotechnology for collaborative research among universities and industry.
So does that make our approach from Canada unique, or are there others that are finding that this is a good way to go too?
Well, I think our approach is unique. I got a lot of requests for copies of my presentation. And part of that also is I tried to give an overview of how we're starting to think about nanotechnology within NINT. And without all the view graphs, I won't go into all the details, but basically what it really tries to show is that we have to try to understand how to build functional complexity into new materials and bridge the gap between hard materials that are primarily used in, say, the communications or manufacturing industries with softer materials that you find in biological systems. And that's really where the opportunities are. It's a new way of thinking. It's not just new things to do.
Now, Canada is essentially one of the new kids on the block as far as nanotechnology goes, and even nanotechnology is a new field. In that sense, what did you come away with from this conference in terms of where Canada fits into the scheme of things the way they are now?
Well, I went away I think, mainly with the confirmation of the feeling that I had at the beginning, and that is, if you take a look at what other countries are doing now, the U.S. will spend something on the order of $1 billion, U.S. dollars, in the next year supporting nanotechnology. Japan is probably getting close to $400 or $500 million U.S. dollars. Even countries like Taiwan and Korea are getting over $100 million U.S. dollars. Europe is probably like $300 million. So what that tells us is that if we really want to compete in this whole area, that we have to learn how to focus. And it's important that we think about what are the technologies that will benefit Canada and what will be the niche. If we try to compete one-on-one with every one of these efforts that are going on, then we will just be so dilute we won't be able to have an impact. So finding the way to focus, and then from that focus, finding the key national and international partnerships that will drive and enhance that focus is really what we have to be doing.
What are we focusing on? Have we got that far yet?
Well, we're just getting close to having our first few researchers in NINT. And we have, I'll say, a general idea of the areas that we want to focus, and it's being driven by something that I call integration. And that is the idea that even if you make small things that could be the size of molecules or a few atoms, we have to learn how to make the connection between the real world and the nano world if we really want to turn things into technologies. And so that has driven a thought process that that has actually allowed us to determine what areas we want to recruit in. And so what we'll be really trying to focus on over the next several years are two things. One will be how do we try to integrate chemical information systems, such as you find in biology, with I'll say traditional information systems, and you know, electronics, photonics, magnetics, as a way to try to develop new types of technologies for diagnostics, for sensing, etc. But the other thing that we will be doing is looking in this community for some of the short-term opportunities to help existing firms commercialize new types of nanotechnologies to start to build a cluster. And those are the two things over the next 5 years that we'll be trying to do.
How is the rest of the world staked out the nanotechnology territory?
Well, that's a hard question, because if you just look at what's going all around the world, it can be intimidating. There's a lot of money going into these fields and a lot of really smart people doing work in these areas. And so it gets back to this question of focus again, and that is that there is not going to be any one thing that we can define that is not being done anywhere else. But we have to choose where we want to compete and then put in the resources that allows us to compete and lead.
Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
That was Dr. Dan Wehner, Acting Director General of the National Institute for Nanotechnology. This weekend, April 26th and 27th, you can celebrate the spring migration at the Swan Festival in Grand Prairie. This northern center is on the flight path for migrating trumpeter swans. These huge white birds weigh about 20 pounds. They have long necks and sound like trumpets. Last fall, I spent some time with Reg Arbuckle of the Ducks Unlimited office in Grand Prairie. We talked about a project called Shadow a Swan, as well as a pair of trumpeter swans that had taken up residence on Crystal Lake.
There's actually a Trumpeter Swan Society project that's actually following trumpeter swans from the Yukon down to their winter range in the tri-state area in the United States. And these swans actually have satellite collars on them where they can track them over the internet, so you can actually log on and link to the Shadow a Swan website and actually follow these birds in their migration from the Yukon down to the States.
How many of them are collared?
Five of them have actually transmitters on, so you can follow five different birds, and three of which have actually moved through here now, and there's another two still coming from the Yukon.
What are things like for trumpeter swans? There was a time when they were on the endangered species list.
Their populations actually have done fairly well, and they actually are pioneering new breeding areas in northeastern BC, Yukon, northwestern Alberta. So their populations are up from what they used to be. And they're probably considered stable, although they're still considered a species of concern in Alberta. So the province still recognizes they have somewhat special status.
The work that you're doing then, following these trumpeter swans from the Yukon down into the States, what is it that you're watching for?
We want to see where they actually stop over and where they like stage during their migration from the north, because these are pretty critical feeding areas for these birds to refuel for their migration down to the United States.
What do they do? What are some of the things that you found out following them?
They've done pretty much what we've kind of expected to this point, because we would have expected them to kind of come through our area because there's lots of food available for them in the fall. And some of them, though, they've kind of tracked through the Rockies and into BC and then kind of come back out into Alberta. So I'm not sure what that was all about, but most of the birds that we've seen come through here have kind of done what we more or less expected. But we're really curious to know what they'll do on their winter range once they get to the United States, to the tri-state area.
What's the winter range like?
The winter range tends to be kind of high mountain areas with a fair degree of geothermal activity, so it keeps the water open. And
so they're down visiting the hot springs?
Yeah, I suppose they would be. They get fairly concentrated, though, in those wintering areas in the tri-state areas, so probably food is the limiting factor, and if there's any extremes in temperature, a lot of that area can freeze over and put them at risk, and also disease by just being concentrated on their winter range can be a problem. So they'd like to expand their winter range if possible, and that's kind of what the collaring program is designed to do, to try to see where they're going to overwinter, and hopefully we can expand the birds' horizons, I guess, on their winter range.
Now, each one of these collared birds actually has a name. What are their names?
Their names are Mayo, Pelly, Tubali, Louie, but they're actually, most of them are named after place names in the Yukon, and so their breeding habitat actually is somewhat mountainous, because the Yukon's pretty much mountains, and there's some pretty productive marshes in some of these mountain systems, and that's where they kind of originate, these collared birds anyway.
So what's Louie been up to?
Louie, we tracked him here, I think, just last weekend to the Grand Prairie area, and he's been kind of checking out some of the area lakes to see what kind of forage he can find, and I think he's going to refuel, and then as soon as the weather kind of turns, they'll be moving on so they don't get stuck in the frozen wasteland that's northern Alberta in the winter.
Well, we're standing on the shores of Crystal Lake, which is just, well, it's within the limits of Grand Prairie now, and there's a bit of a housing development going up. And you've come out to show me a trumpeter swan, a family. You say they're a bit of an anomaly.
Here at Crystal Lake, this is a natural marsh that's been here since the last ice age, and the city has gradually kind of grown around it, but it's still a productive waterfall lake as long as the birds can kind of habituate to the people and the activity that's going on. So we're trying to maintain as much of a buffer around the lake as possible and kind of leave the birds to themselves, kind of thing.
What's this pair of swans been doing?
This lake actually has had, for the first year in maybe 25 years, it's actually had a pair of swans raise cygnets on the lake. And I think they started out with five, and we're probably down to four or so now. But this is the first year that this pen has actually raised cygnets that we know of, and she's probably 6 years old. And but they've done so far, they've done pretty good, and I'm not sure. I haven't followed them that closely, but I expect them to fledge some of the cygnets this fall. And I thought I saw them here this morning, but I can't find them now. So if they're just feeding somewhere in the bulrushes, I'm not sure. But they have to get flying pretty soon, or they're not going to make it. So,
for trumpeter swans, what's the concern over their habitat, and what does have an effect on their population?
Well, probably the biggest thing that would impact them is, you know, how much forage there is available to them and how much disturbance there might be to their kind of routine nesting, cygnet, rearing, that kind of thing. And that can affect how they actually use a marsh or where they can access forage, that kind of thing. So we'd be concerned about, say, quad use along shorelines, that kind of thing, during the brood rearing season.
Does farming affect them?
Typically, unless you clear right to the very edge of the wetland, there's some kind of a buffer, and farming tends to be short-term duration activities, so they've kind of managed to habituate to that. If there's more activity in terms of, say, oil and gas development, that kind of thing, where there's lots of traffic every day and there's not adequate buffers around a wetland or something like that, then that would maybe be a concern.
What's the work of Ducks Unlimited up here now?
Ducks Unlimited is in the business of securing and restoring wetland habitats, so both wetlands and native uplands around the shores of wetlands. They're vital kind of upland nesting habitat for a lot of dabbling ducks.
Thanks very much, Reg.
Well, thank you.
That was Reg Arbuckle, a resource specialist with Ducks Unlimited in Grand Prairie. We had no sooner finished our interview when the family of trumpeter swans appeared from behind the rushes. They swam around a bit, made some calls, then took flight and disappeared, all except for the smallest cygnet that couldn't quite get up over the trees.
Flying, that's awesome.
That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during the program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. You can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the University of Lethbridge, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, ICOR, the Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the Alberta Ingenuity Fund, Capital Region Innovation Centre, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, True North Energy, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Research Council, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.